chairperson is on the way, so we have thought that maybe it would be better to keep the ball rolling until she comes. She's about to come. So while we are expecting our chairperson, firstly, I would like to welcome the IPC. I hope we all know that this meeting is a follow-up with the IPC on their capacity in taking forward the measures as agreed to in the framework agreement. This is the Economic Development Portfolio Committee meeting, and its chair is Maturale Coleman. So we would like to do the rituals. I'll start by introducing myself. I'm Chris Ntuli, who is the whip of this committee. So I'll just start with the members on my left to introduce themselves. Then I'll give it to the DG to take over and CEO to take over to introduce the department. I'll start with Babu Mabaso.
Shitango Mabasa, member of the committee.
Hi, Long Trading, member of the committee as well.
Chariwa, member of committee.
Matungonya, member of the committee.
Pia Rabi, member of the committee.
Naren Singh, a member of this committee.
Thank you, honorable members. I think today, members, we are challenged. The gender sensitivity, gender balance, seems as if we've got a Spartamia group. We hope it will be corrected as we are moving forward. We've got our committee secretary, Eric Okotse, on my right hand side. Then I'll give to the department the leader. You do the ritual. Thanks.
Thanks, Chair. I'm Nimrod Zolk. I'm Deputy Director General of the Industrial Development Division at the Department of Trade and Industry, which is the division which exercises oversight over the Industrial Development Corporation.
Thanks, Mr. Ntuli. My name is Jeffrey Queen. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Industrial Development Corporation of South Africa. I've got a team, some of the members at the back, when I call their names, Chair, they will just stand up so that the other members can see them. We've got Takane Makuba. He's the head of our department called Post-Investment Monitoring. And then we've got Lindi Toi. She's the head of the PPP unit, the Public-Private Partnerships. And then we've got Olisa Jafta. She's our economist. And then I've got next to me Shakil Mir. He's the divisional executive for industrial. And then right behind me, I've got Christo Van Sale. He's our strategist. And that's the team that we've brought, Mr. Julian. We've tried to be gender sensitive.
Thank you very much for that. I'm not sure who is going to break the ice. Is it the deputy director or it's you? But whoever, I hope you know who's going to give us the presentation. It can be the breaking ice and then the presentation. Thank you. It's up to you.
Well, thank you, Chair. I suggest that we go straight into the presentation by the CEO.
You don't want to say something to the committee.
If it's pushed, the chair, I suppose by way of follow-up, the IDC has been identified as a very important institution, although by no means the only institution in responding to the economic crisis. I think the from where we stand as Department of Trade and Industry, the IDC has been certainly amongst the institutions that responded most rapidly by setting aside specific funds to assist distressed sectors and also reorienting themselves internally to assist firms that have been in distress as a result of the economic crisis. So they've played a very, very important role, a role that's necessarily been circumscribed by what's possible within their balance sheet, which is a commercially funded balance sheet. But I think the full detail of that will come out in the presentation.
Thank you very much. So, yes, our
chairperson has arrived. We would like to chairperson the deputy director has already broke the ice, so we are waiting for the IDC to start the presentation. You arrived at the right time. Thank you. You can continue.
Thanks. Good morning, Chair.
Morning.
Thank you for affording us another opportunity to come and engage with the committee as a follow-up from the first interaction we've had with this committee. The presentation is broadly just in two parts. The first part is just a direct response on the capacity and what we've done in the distress sector. But what we've done, we've put in the second part that gives a sense of what we've done in the previous financial period and part of this financial period, which is still almost about 6 months into it, to give a committee a sense of what the IDC does, because, I mean, it's our really initial interaction, and also that follows from the questions that we got last time, so that if we at least share some of the examples of the activities that we do, and hopefully in that demonstrate really the capacity we have and ability to do more. So hopefully that will happen then, and then we will engage with questions. Chair, I brought a little bit of a bigger team this time, so that the committee has a sense of who does what at the IDC. But as they say, strength comes in numbers. Hopefully that will assist as well. In terms of the first part, if you look in what we've done as IDC, we've allocated about 3.7 billion to infrastructure projects. Because we're saying whilst the country is going through this downturn, it is important for us to continue to assist companies in distress, but side by side with that, create new projects, but also help in terms of building in the infrastructure. The 3.7 you'll see, which has been allocated last year, was about 2.6. Primarily, will be used to fund public-private partnerships. I will give examples of what we've done in the previous to give the committee sense, but also some of that will be used for infrastructure projects in the rest of the African continent. But we know that we will not be able to do this on our own. That is why we will ensure that we work together with the state-owned entities but also with other DFIs like the DBSA as well, where they need permits. But also what we're doing as far as participating in the industrial and the trade in, on the trade policy, we participate in a number of task teams, the automotive, the capital equipment, and the textiles. In fact, Shaquille, who sits next to me, is heavily involved in that. We work very closely with the Department of Trade and Industry in those to try and come up with solutions to assist those sectors, because that's where, particularly on the textiles and automotive, that's where we've seen a great need. I think that will be evidenced by the next couple of slides where I show what we've done. We have budgeted for the year that we are under 11.4 billion to be approved, of which, if you compare that with the previous year, that was 10.8. But in that, there's also an amount of distress funding of 2.9. But subsequently, we've looked at that. The 11.4 was right at the beginning of the year when we were budgeting. And then we've increased that to 12.6 because we've seen during this year that we're in that there's additional demand, particularly for the expansion. So in total, I mean, it will be 12.6. As I indicated in the previous interaction with the committee, 6.1 billion over 2 years has been available to assist companies in distress, of which 2.9 is for this year under review, and then the 3.2 is for the following period. But what we're also doing is an initiative by the Department of Trade and Industry on scaling up the industrial policy action plans. IDC is playing a role in assisting the department in that regard. In our effort to assist, one of the outcomes that we want to ensure that is attained is saving jobs, particularly for those companies that are in distress. So our target is that we'll be able to create and save jobs to the tune of 38,000 compared to 26,000, which we've achieved. So we've actually scaled up our target so that we can do a little bit more, because it is important, particularly for the companies that are in distress, that those jobs are saved. We participate in the different task teams, which is, I think, one of the reasons why we're here today, to really give input, be it in the investment and the financing task team or in the distress sectors task team, so that we can ensure that there's coordination and implementation of those of that framework. Now, if you look at what we've done to date, as far as assisting companies that are in distress, for the previous financial year, 485 million was approved for 14 distressed companies, and then I think at the bottom, if you look at the bottom of the slide there, that gives a split of the companies that have been assisted per province. And then on the left, it gives the different sectors in which the funding has gone, the food, beverage, mining, and beneficiation. That's the values. So, now, from the 1st of April 2009 to September, we've approved about just shy of a billion rand for 15 companies who are in distress. And then for this current financial year, we're hoping that these approvals will have the ability of saving about 5,400 jobs. So this is the new money for new companies which ordinarily would not have been IDC clients. But internally as well, we've experienced some of the clients that have also gone into distress. We've assisted 16 of our existing clients to restructure their funding. By restructuring, we mean we'd either give them capital moratorium, we'd either reschedule the loans, we'd either give them a holiday, an extended holiday of repayment, or we'd capitalize their interest so that we can give them that breather. But also what we've done, we've in the nature of funding, Chair, some of the companies that when we looked at them and we looked at the ability to come out in the long term, medium to long term, we have rejected 13 companies because we felt even if we were to put in all the funding, they wouldn't be able to be saved. In terms of the pipeline, what we have, just over 2.3 billion, which is currently in the pipeline, from 33 applications. In terms of where they are, in terms of the stage, 24 are in the basic assessment, which is the initial screening. There it involves either getting more details, looking at the business plans, and the 9 have advanced to the due diligence stage, where the teams have gone in and have looked in more detail so that they can be able to assist. We are mindful of the time that we have to take. We have to respond much quicker than we all would want to, because we want to make sure that when we come up with a solution, it's a solution that is relevant, but that is responsive, so that we don't come up with a perfect solution after the fact. So we're mindful of that. And we know in terms of the sectorial split, I mean, that gives a sense, the table that gives us. The bulk of that is in the manufacturing, we see that particularly in the automotive and the components side. We have some on the franchising and the mining as well. What we do, I think in line with what the Minister of Trade and Industry has encouraged us to look at, is that when we approve some of these fundings, particularly for these companies that are in distress, or even, in fact, when we restructure them, we put in some conditionalities, but we in the process also ensure that we are practical about this, because what we're trying to do is to save the situation. And then on a case-by-case basis, we look at either the remuneration or the payments of dividends, because in some cases we'd say then if we're going to restructure and the company's in distress, it does not make sense for us that there be dividends be paid or shareholders' loans be repaid, because we'd want the money to rather stay in the company and be able to assist in the situation and help prevent the job losses. And in some cases, we would encourage the companies to ensure that the loans to the banks, or at least we engage with the banks as far as the repayment is concerned, so that we try and keep everybody in. I think this to us has taught us now that this is probably even more than before. That is the time for us to, as far as possible, ensure that we crowd in the banks, because we have found in some of the instances that they've been very reluctant in assisting. But we've established contact points with, particularly with the big four banks, where we've engaged with them to encourage them to stay. I mean, sometimes it has taken a little bit longer than we would want to, but I think we've had successes. I mean, although mixed, but to a large extent, very positive. As far as job losses is concerned, we try and ensure that is minimized. In fact, if we can afford not to have any job losses at all, we that's first prize. So, but it might happen in some cases in the process of restructuring that there's maybe a few jobs that might be lost, but it's something that we try and make sure that it's to the bare minimum. In terms of looking at our constraints as IDC, so that we are able to respond to this, when we started the year, we had thought it would be very difficult to raise funding, particularly from the traditional sources. We found that it's not as probably as difficult as we thought, although the cost is higher compared to the years before. I mean, before the global meltdown. But we found that we have been able to raise the funding, although at relatively higher costs. But what we've also done is we've made significant progress in finalizing our first private bond placement. In fact, we're doing that with the UIF, which is, I think, it's a first and it's a good thing. And we're preparing to do a domestic bond, which we will issue probably late next year, but the appetite is there. But we're also exploring a number of other options. I mean, going into areas we've never gone, be it in the Middle East or even in Asia, where we've made good progress and we've been able to access funding. So I would say if we have to raise funding, I think it's one area where, I mean, with the amount of work that we've done, I'm particularly comfortable that, I mean, we will be able to raise funding too, so that we can be able to really address the extended needs that we've seen. But we know in terms of our profits that they will be severely impacted because those have been an element of ensuring that we reinvest that. But we know they'll be severely impacted because of the restructuring that I've referred to, either capital moratorium or reduced levels of dividends that we will get. But we're saying in spite of that, we will be able to have good access funding. What we've done different scenarios, stress testing, which we're presenting to our board next week. And from that, it has clearly demonstrated that we can, in fact, even if there's a need that arises, we can actually even double the amount made available for companies in distress and still be able to fund those from the different sources. So from that stress testing, I'm comfortable that we have the ability to can do more. In terms of human resource, because that goes with the increased demand, we the process of filling the vacancies that we've had, I think that's going well. And what we've done, because different sectors have got different needs, so we've seen in some sectors the uptake has been slower than we had anticipated. So we have been able to redeploy people to units where there's a greater demand. So for an example, if there's a slack in franchising, we've redeployed those people to Metas, for an example, so that they can assist. So that one is doing well. What we continually investigating is that if there's a need beyond that, I mean, I think we have the ability to can use people on a part-time basis. But for as we speak now, Chair, we haven't seen a need for that. I think with the redeployment and the vacancies that we've been filling, I think we have the human capital ability to be able to respond timeously to the request. Now, coming to the second part, as I said, Chair, just to give also in response to some of the questions that the members raised last term, we thought let's just give the committee a sense of what we've achieved over the past financial year. We have approved, as I said, just over 11 billion, and if you look at the 6 months now, about 3.4 billion has already been approved for the 6 months. That now, in totality, including all the other normal funding that we've had. I mean, that comes from the 72 transactions that we've seen this year. So that would include even the transactions that are in distress, the 15 that I referred to earlier. In terms of the examples, what we've there's a couple of slides, about three or so, where we've given some sense of the different projects we've done per province. We've tried to split it per province so that we give them, the committee members, a sense. It's not a comprehensive list of everything, but it gives a sense. In terms of the split, the graph on the right, it shows a split, and I think it's pretty clear that there's still a bias towards other provinces, which is one of the reasons why we opened offices in the different provinces, so that we can try and make sure that we see those opportunities, ensure that those offices assist and align themselves with the provincial growth and development strategies of each province. So some of the examples in the Eastern Cape will be the citrus and the pomegranate in a rural area. Of course, what we've also tried to do is to pick up, to give the committee a sense, some of the things that are in rural areas, some of them that are in townships, but it's also different types of things. I mean, we're looking at in East London, for an example, the base manufacturer of flat screen televisions. What we have not included is the names. I think we've deliberately not included that so that we or some clients that we fund prefer not their names to be made known. But here it's a mix of the companies that are not necessarily in distress, but all the companies that we funded. I mean, because we're demonstrating that whilst we fund companies in distress, but we still do the normal IDC funding. In terms of the free stage, we see in the emerging pharma about $3 million. That's in the and it's largely what we've looked at here is in the food, beverage, and agro industries side. And then in Gauteng, we've seen emerging construction, but also we've seen, in fact, the first one, which is the washing pound. I think this is probably one of the good success stories where small players we've assisted to grow and is now competing with multinationals, and then it's a South African company. But also we've seen that we're looking at enterprise that will produce the consent, and we're working with the CSIR as well, because that's one thing that we we do is we work with different other, be it private sector, but also other government-owned entities. But the last one, maybe that's worth mentioning, the development of the local aerospace cluster. To us there, we're seeing really a relatively modest company being able to provide high-tech and high-quality service to multinationals, people like Boeing and Airbus, in which we are assisting from the South African expertise. In KwaZulu-Natal, I think we're looking at S Moving and the bioethanol and the channel fiber.
We can read those. If you can just move to the next one. Yeah.
Thanks, Chair. Maybe what is worth mentioning, and the first one in KwaZulu-Natal, that's one of the big ones in terms of the companies that are in distress that that is funded. That's about $250 million. That gives you a sense of what we've covered there. So I mean, it shows different sectors, and in terms of companies that are in rural areas, about 44 approvals to the extent of $1.1 billion. And in terms of those that are in the townships, about 27 approvals. In terms of SMEs, I think we've seen a rise in number, although by value, naturally, then that would be the big project that we do. So we've seen a steady rise, which we've maintained there. In terms of if you look at our approvals sectorially, we still see PPP value-wise would be naturally big, and the mining will be the big one. But we've seen an activity cutting across a number of sectors. I mean, we also do venture capital, even though venture capital value-wise might be small, but that's higher risk. I think that's where you find that there's new technologies that will come in, because we've seen that in most of these successful countries, venture capital is an area which you want to ensure that you invest in. The last two slides, which I've just added now, just to give the, I know they're not in the pack necessarily, we added them this morning, they just give the committee a sense of the financial strength, although I've demonstrated that we can access it, that last year we made $5.6 billion. But as I said, that we will see that figure be reducing much, much more. But over time, we've been able to build a relatively healthy balance sheet that will able us to do all of this. If you look at our reserves, at the previous financial year, they're sitting at the $65 billion. That's why I'm saying we'll be able to either borrow and leverage from those to ensure that we can do more. Chair, I will pause there, and I think we can take questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think you have managed to cover everything, but then we had requested for individual companies per province. And I take it that is still coming. We haven't received it. For the purposes of members visiting any company, if they wish to, in any province, because that would assist to just to check whether there's any progress or whether the man is assisting or not assisting. It is important that we do get that list per province. I heard you saying some companies don't want you to mention their names, but it is important for us because we are intervening here as a state and as government, and would want to know whether our money, the money that we are intervening on, is really bearing any fruits or not. Thank you very much. We will now welcome questions. I take it that the people you've brought in here are going to be able to respond.
I hope so.
Yeah. Actually, they possess such expertise, so they will be able to, I take it. Can we get questions from our side? Ms. Dendulin, the Rabbi, Mr. Wong, Mr. Singh. Mr. Mabaso. Okay. In the order, please.
Thanks, Chairperson. And thanking the the CEO for the presentation. Chairperson, I heard the CEO talking about profit. Who is making the profit? The ITC is at they are still going to check whether there is profit. I just wanted to check that one. Number two is the he also talk about the filling of vacancies. Who is filling the vacancies? Is it the distressed companies or the ITC? Plus the temporary contractors. I want to find out who is using those temporary contractors. Are the distressed companies or is it the ITC? Lastly, I wanted to agree with you with this value for money. Because we want to find out whether are we doing well, do we have any impact during this situation. We want to find out so that we don't say we are doing this, we are doing that, we are doing this, but at the end then we say, hey, we have failed. We want to check that whether we are going to succeed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ntuli. Okay. When you're saying filling of vacancies, in relation to which area or aspect that they're
bringing?
Oh, he will be able to.
Yeah.
You understand. Okay. Thank you. I wanted to be clear so that they understand the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First and foremost, just a general comment. I think that Madam Chair, it would be very good for us as a committee if we could get the opportunity to do an on-site inspection to some of these companies that's been assisted by the IDC. I think it
will
give us
that item will be coming when we're dealing with our own business.
Yes, fine. Yes. But this is just a general comment, Madam Chair. The second thing is the second, but it's the last slide, the number of sectors that are the distribution of approvals. Now, Madam Chair, I believe something like 37 companies in the clothing, textiles, and leather and footwear industry sector has closed down this year. And I see that the degree of support to them, I'm referring to the last slide there, is less than 5% of your total approvals. I'd just like to get further clarity on this because this is a very labor-intensive sector of the economy, Madam Chair, and I think it's important that thousands of jobs were at stake. And then secondly, tourism. Madam Chair, I see there that the tourism was also about 6% of the approvals was given to companies involved in tourism. Now, from a rural perspective, tourism is one of the few sectors of the economy that provides employment to people in the tourist industry. And I believe that something like 8% of our total GDP is made out of tourism and so forth. And I was heard that they say that many of other of the of our competing economies, something like 14% of some of our trade partners, something like 14% of their total GDP is tourism. So I'd just like to get clarity, why is tourism and the clothing and leather and footwear industries, why is their approval just about less than 5% of the total approvals? Maybe they'd be able to put us further into the picture. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Rabi. If you remember in our last meeting, engagement with the IGC, that question was raised. And we thought perhaps this time there would be further clarity regarding that, that issue of why this... The main labor intensive, you know, sectors are not really prioritized. I hope that this time we'll get a proper answer, Mr. Tina. Thank you. Can we get Dr. Wang? Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, I appreciate for the CEO your presentation. My first question is for your update for the funding district, the funding approval is slide. You say it's 13 funding for application rejected. This one, you keep the sustainable in the long term. I want to know how long is your long term is you sustainable. Then for the second question is from the your approval for the 9 province, this all the funding. You say from your presentation, you say it's already approved about 3.4 billion rand. But I calculated from these 9 provinces, especially for the KwaZulu-Natal. If you from KwaZulu-Natal, it's the first item is this for the working capital for this manufacturer for export for earth moving equipment. You didn't indicate how much it is budget that you already approved. If under this budget approved, all the 9 provinces, you only approve for 1.9 billion. So from the your 3.4 billion, I don't know how you calculate coming to the total together for 3.4 billion. Then from the your other slide is represented for 44.
Just to step you, Mr. Huang.
Yes.
That 250 million was referring to the first.
One company. The first, so I asked in the first one, he didn't indicate inside.
Okay.
If U252 is a plus inside, you still showed for the total, its amount is 2.1 billion. For the U3.4, it still showed the 1.2 billion. I don't know where this 1.2 billion came from. Then the your other area from the regional development for 44 approved by the rural area. This is including for the other 9 provinces, for the approval or not. If including the inside, I still want to know is the indicator for the all the allocation is every province you keep the balance or not. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Singh?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I may just touch on some of the other issues that were raised by previous colleagues. But I'd just like to know from the IDC, the emphasis here, is it on saving companies or saving jobs? Because the CEO did tell us that there were 13 companies that were rejected, and we know you just can't put money into a sinkhole that just gets wasted. But probably the emphasis should be on saving jobs, because throughout your presentation in the beginning, you spoke about the number of jobs that have been saved and will continue to be saved. The other question, Chairperson, I'd just like to ask, I mean, for what period are we looking at this distress? I mean, there are talks of the recession... we're looking at maybe it bottoming out and things are going to look a little brighter. So for what period have you as IDC budgeted for that? And also just to follow my colleague here, the textile and clothing industry, because to us as people on the ground, from what we see, I mean, that industry is taking the most strain because we interact with people who lose their jobs on a daily basis. And it's also as a result of the competition that you get from countries like India, China, and other countries with cheaper goods being brought into the country. So, you know, why isn't there much emphasis on saving jobs within the clothing and textile? The last question is, we see some agricultural projects. Now, there's a cashew nut project on the north of KwaZulu-Natal. that hasn't been all that successful. Now, I don't know if any lessons have been learned. And maybe at the next meeting, Chairperson, they can tell us, in the last 3 years, how many projects have not been sustainable that you have funded? Thank you.
Mr. Mabaso.
Thank you, Colleague Chair. My first question would be where funding is provided to companies. Is there a support mechanism which also accompanies the funding so that you know the responsibility of safeguarding or of making sure that the funding has the effect that we desire, you know, is influenced? And but the second one is because funding can easily go into non-job creating avenues where a company can choose to enrich itself if it sees that as a priority over job creations, because that balance is so do we have a way of influencing companies to say this is what we are interested in and we will monitor you accordingly? And but then the third one is typically some of the areas that go slightly forgotten are the small businesses. I have noted with appreciation that 69% go to SMEs. Should I assume that areas like the industrial parks, because those are the areas that are developed usually in poor areas, you know, in township areas, etc. For an example, Orlando Industrial Park, Tembisa, does IDC have a focus on such? And when we talk of SMEs, are cooperatives part of them, you know, in your experience? Then there is that area where we talk of investment in bonds, noting that we are in this international turmoil economically. I hope and take it that, you know, the risks and the benefits associated with that will have been well balanced, because it can become a plus, but it can easily become a negative because of that turmoil. The last 2 points, Comrade Chair, on slide 6. Let me see, or is this the one I've spoken to already? Oh, yes, yeah, on slide 6, when we assist companies, what criteria do we use that assist us to make a choice of which companies? But also, is our interest spreading the resources across a number of companies, or will we say our interest is more the lesser the companies, so that we see the impact? I know it's a challenge, because you could also say if we spread our assistance right across, there are benefits, but also if we focus. So I just want to have a feel of how you look at that. Then the very last one is where on slide 9, when we talk of utilizing contractors on a part-time basis. I know, CEO, that you qualified it and said that you have not gone all the way to utilize that. But I just want to caution that sometimes when part-time potential users or part-time potential is available, it is very easy to find that even what you could have done yourself, unawares or very unconsciously, you tend to outsource it. So just a comment on that. Thanks, Colleague Chair.
Thanks, Comrade Mabaso. Mr. Sailor.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I mean, my question is also around the criteria and the conditions for funding. Like, I know, for instance, in the stimulus package of America, for instance, the money that was given to the automotive industry there was on condition that they actually produce more fuel-efficient cars and things like that. Is there any specific conditions that we've attached to some of the funding that we've given to companies? And that leads to my next issue as well. Is it, what's the interface between the funding that we give and the industrial policy? I mean, are we looking at sufficiently diversifying our economy away from a minerals energy base? And to what role does the IDC play in terms of actually putting those investments through? And I see that, and that's probably why you've also produced the new venture capital sector as well. And I see you haven't mentioned, I suppose my bias, but I see you haven't mentioned particular renewable energy projects. Is that a sector that you are looking at funding and giving through, and what is happening in that sector? And then just lastly, I know one of the conditions was that companies actually retrain their workers if they get funding from government. Is that taking place, and how successful is that? What kind of projects are going in terms of that particular condition? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Khwela. Ma'am, for this.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is on conditions attached to approvals and legislate aid and together with the progress in addressing constraints. I think the main purpose of funding by IDC is to make a meaningful contribution towards the economic development in the country. But with so many labor strikes, I don't think we'll realize our vision for that economic development. I would like to know if this is some of the conditions that the IDC considers when they do the funding, that they're non-compliant with the basic conditions of employment, as it's one of the major reasons why we have so many strikes. And also from the Department of Labor, we have information that many companies do not comply with employment equity. And here you have your filling of vacancies if you do consider if companies do comply with that. And the third one is that the last time we requested physical addresses of the companies were funded so that we can make oversight based on the information that you have provided us with. And no, I think that's it for now.
Thanks, ma'am, for that. Maybe I should also put mine. I think what is important is that to understand from your side, I don't know whether you did mention in the previous meeting the difference in terms of the interest charged by yourself compared to that of the traditional banks. I think that would be quite important. Yes, we are facing a recession, and that has a high impact on the poorest of the poor. And I think creation of jobs and prevention of job losses is quite essential. And that brings me to a question whether your intervention, is it needs-based or is it related or following the government priorities? I think that is, to me, very, very important that we get. Because if it follows that, then it means that we will be able to alleviate the poverty that we are facing, and that is actually trying to rise because of the challenges of this recession. You have mentioned here on slide 6 the number of companies assisted, and in some provinces you mentioned one, whereas when you go to the detailed list, you have more than one company. I don't know whether that is a mistake or you have a reason for doing so. That would actually help. And in terms of funding restructuring, you are saying this might affect or that might lead to us losing some jobs. I don't know what does that mean and how do those relate? Because if a company say we're restructuring our funding, does it mean that they are also shedding some jobs within and that is part of the restructuring? I heard you explaining that, but I'm not sure whether I did understand quite well. You're saying you have raised money you in terms of the mitigating. Thank you. Oh, your constraints, yes. You're saying you have the one area, for instance, or one option that you have is that of raising more funds from the traditional sources. What I want to know is, don't you have investments that you put aside to cater for such eventualities? Because to me it makes business sense, unless you are saying to, for instance, if you were now to utilize that money, you would be losing in terms of the benefit of that investment. And whether are we in the business of making profit, I think the question that was raised by Mr. Ndulu is quite relevant. But as government, what we know that we set up this institution, state-owned enterprises, to intervene, to be an in-betweener between, you see, the traditional DFIs and, the institutions that are dealing with financing and ourselves as government. And if we are in the business of making profit with an aim of sustaining ourselves, how should we do it, or how are we doing it so that we can differentiate between, those institutions that are really meant to make profit because they're in business, in the real business, and ourselves as government? I think that would assist, and I just want to follow up on some of the questions that were raised, because you see, the questions related to the prioritization by IDC in terms of financing of distressed companies doesn't seem to be following. I'm still waiting for that response. I think I'm asking it in another way now, or other way around, because you see, it will be important that you convince this committee, because we are monitoring whether you are able to respond sufficiently to this recession, the companies that are in distress, or you are not. And where possible, we can be able to assist. Hence, we've requested for those, as Memso did, so say maybe physical addresses or details in terms of the company's names and so forth. It will be very, very important. This question, I think when you respond to it, please make sure that you put everything in place. You respond to it adequately so that it doesn't arise again, because it keeps on arising, and you can see why, because members are quite frustrated, because when we look at the figures and when we look at the plans for the coming, financial, it doesn't give us an indication as to whether you are going to be changing direction to focus more on the companies that are going to be saving jobs or not. Is it an afterthought, Mr. Ngwenyama?
Yes,
please. I normally don't allow that in my meetings, but should we give you first, or should we give the IDC? Or you wanted to?
I think it can.
It can come later. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kwena. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks for the questions to the members. It's actually good I have my Director General here, Deputy Director General, who's going to assist particularly on some of the questions on whether we're following government, or we're leading, and what I will do is I will allow him maybe to start. But before he starts, Chair, maybe just one comment on the why we have not given the names, of which we will give the names, Chair, to the committee. Because what we're conscious of, particularly when we enter into a relationship with companies, is some companies get a sense, if the world knows they're in distress,
it might have a chain effect of unintended consequences. You might have some of the creditors now calling up their names, their loans rather, or some of the banks. So it is in that context, that's why we have not given public. But we will give, because we've got a list, we'll give the committee, particularly for the committee to do an oversight, to go and visit, to do that. But we have not publicly said it, because if you're working for a company and then you see in the news that this company is in distress, you are worried as an employee, and the all other things unintended might happen. But maybe let me give the DDG to address some of the questions, and then I'll get assistance on the others. Yeah.
Okay. What implications does that have if you were to release the names to us now? Because you're saying they don't want to have to get enter into any agreement with the companies or what? Because you're saying there are repercussions.
As a follow-up, Chair, what we'll do is, I think we'll appreciate that the committee members will keep them in confidence, but we have a relationship. We'll go back to the client. And in terms of the agreements we have with them, when there's a need for us to release that information, our agreements permit us to do that. But what we will not encourage is that those names become in the media, because, as I said, they might have unintended consequences. But the companies are there, then the committee will get the names. Because the other committees also do site visits for some of those other, not necessarily the ones in distress, but any other companies, so that they can see that those jobs that we say are there, that the companies exist, that the impact that they make. So we'll give those.
Of course, currently we're interested in those that are under distress as a committee. I think we'll deal with that issue later on in detail. Thank you. Mr. Nimrod?
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me perhaps make some broader comments before our colleagues at the IDC make specific responses. I think the one point that we need to raise and look at is, one of the questions that was raised is, well, for how long should this facility remain in place for distressed companies? Given that, you know, that some people are saying, you know, there are these so-called green shoots that are showing up, and we may be coming out of the recession. From DTI point of view and from our observation, notwithstanding the fact that there may be some evidence in some sectors of the economy of a imminent recovery, manufacturing in particular remains in deep distress. So I think we need to be very, very vigilant with respect to the manufacturing sector and the potential, really making sure that we don't lose further jobs and industrial capability in the manufacturing sector. So that is a very, very big challenge. I think a second broad issue that was raised is, you know, what is the interface with industrial policy? You know, to what extent does the IDC respond to the priorities, the sectoral priorities of government and DTI in particular? What I can say, certainly, I would say over the recent period, the last year to 18 months, there's been a much closer and more cooperative relationship between the DTI and the IDC, and we've certainly observed increased effort on the IDC's part to align its efforts with our industrial policy objectives. But I think it's important for us to also contextualize the role that the IDC can play in responding to this crisis. And I think just to be clear on some of the things that it can respond to and some of the things that it can't respond to. So, you know, there were issues around a couple of sectors, tourism, for instance, clothing and textiles, where the issues facing a range of sectors are much broader than what the IDC can respond to, because the IDC is essentially responding, let's call it, to some of the supply-side conditions of companies you know, providing, coming in and providing working capital or restructuring loans. Often, and I think, you know, tourism is a good example of this, the fundamental difficulty is a reduction in demand because economic growth has contracted so rapidly. So I think that we need to view the role of the IDC more holistically in terms of government's overall response to the economic crisis. So I think that also is a partial explanation of why, you know, the IDC, maybe some of the differences in sectors where the IDC is able to respond. You know, it may be the case that, you know, that notwithstanding the IDC's, you know, willingness to extend credit and extend loan facilities, it may be that the broader economic conditions that are facing these companies are, you know, are so difficult that there's no, let's say, light at the end of the tunnel. And I think that that's a large reason for why there have been some rejections. I think related to that is, the IDC has indicated that they have been seeking out sources of funds. But again, I think it's very important to understand that the sources of funds that they access, you know, they have to go out to commercial capital markets to access these funds, whether they borrow locally or internationally, or whether they, you know, issue a bond to try and raise some of this financing. It comes at a commercial cost, and that necessarily limits their ability to provide a large differential between what companies could source financing from commercial banks and the extent that the IDC can extend concessionality in its funding. So, to be more specific, I think the IDC has not received a capital injection from the state since the 1950s. So it's a fully self-financing institution, and that's the constraints in which it needs to operate. Now, there are some anomalies, perhaps across different DFIs. For instance, you know, the IDC is a tax-paying institution, but other development finance institutions such as the DBSA, are not. So you know, perhaps that's one thing that should be looked at, is to say, you know, let's kind of make the playing field level across DFIs. And I'm sure the chair will respond more. The CEO will respond more specifically with respect to the issue of, you know, profits and dividends and so on, which really essentially go back to the state and go into the fiscus. There was a specific set of questions around renewables, which I think really talks to the future direction of industrial policy. We're in the process as DTI of developing a revised industrial policy action plan, and one of the areas that we will almost certainly include is green industries and looking at the possibilities that arise, you know, for green industries, green jobs, green technologies in a range of areas. And I think that necessarily will also influence the direction of IDC funding. Thank you.
Thanks, TTG. On that, I will ask maybe just because you've touched on the renewables, that Lindi Doi would expand a little bit on that front, Chair.
Chair, if I may just add on the renewable side, I think as IDC we've positioned ourselves very carefully. We have developed the expertise on the carbon credits and clean development mechanism. And secondly, if I can just expand on energy, including renewable energy, you need as a funder like IDC, you need a power purchase agreement. And I think we are all aware of the limitations that ESCOM is having you are saying National Treasury having to come up with the money, DOE having to look at the legislation, NELSA having to look at the pricing. So it's quite a few people that have to make decisions for people like IDC and other funders. And if you look at just at the overall environment, people are spending money trying to develop renewable energy projects, but they are not getting the critical part of it, which is the power purchase agreement.
Thanks, Linda. I mean, we there's a number of projects, I think, which we can share with the committee that we've done, we've developed it all, be it wind, which we're working on, be it on biofuels, which we're working on, be on the solar, which we're working on, because that's an area which we need to develop. It's a long-term type project, but it's that. On the textiles and all that related, Chair, Shaquille will talk about those, and then we'll address the specific ones, which are just clarifications.
There were one or two questions relating to clothing and textiles. In fact, the questions are correct in the sense that it is an industry under threat from competition. It's been struggling for a long period. If you look at the value of approvals, one of the things which makes it difficult to compare, a lot of the clothing manufacturers are not very capital intensive. So if you look at the value of approvals compared to something like mining, it would be a lot smaller. But we do have a business unit focused specifically on that sector. We are probably the major financier into that sector in South Africa, if you compare us with the commercial banks, who are a bit hesitant to lend in that sector. Over and above supporting normal expansions and companies in distress, we've also introduced a specific scheme where we are looking at trying to encourage the sector to modernize so that it can compete more effectively, and that's a highly subsidized rate of prime minus 5. And the reason for that is exactly because of the type of competition we're facing. If as an industry we don't modernize and invest in best practices, we're never going to catch up and we're going to actually lose the sector. So by having this subsidized rate, we're trying to encourage companies to move in that direction. So we do see it as a key sector, and it is something we have a strong focus on.
Thanks, Shaquille. If we look at in the previous presentation on the textiles, we showed the portfolios that we had, the sizes of the different portfolios. The investment, if you look at the size of the investment that we have in the textile, it's actually 1.2 billion which we've invested. The approvals that have shown in it, that's for the financial aid that we've done. So if you look on overall in terms of the investments, that's 1.2. And in fact, on the tourism, I mean, the size of our investment is just about 3 billion rand. So we have invested, but I mean, it might happen that from year to year, the approvals on that year might vary. They might create an impression that we're not to that extent. Maybe the question that talks about the interest charge, I think the DDG has touched on it, but I think it will be worthwhile just to put in a context, our sources of funding, Chair. Firstly, it's the loans that we go out and we raise, be it syndications where a club of banks would come in, or be it bilaterals where naturally those will be with DFIs, international DFIs, be it either in the East, in Asia, or in Europe predominantly. But also we're looking at our investments that we have, because we do, as I showed, the size of investments that we have. So we would sell some of those investments. So it's a combination of all of that. And I think as the DDG has said, because we raise some of this, so that the buffer that we have so that we can pass that benefit is probably not as large as the banks would have, because the banks take deposits and they give you very low returns and then they can pass on that benefit. But what we do is when we look at the pricing, we look at the risk, and because we take long-term, I mean, broadly our funding is long-term. Because we take a long-term approach, I think that's probably the benefit that we bring in, but we try and price for the risk that we take. So where also for what we give as for those that create more jobs, more direct jobs, because it's easier for us to measure the direct jobs, then they will get a bit more benefit than the ones that do not create probably as much of the direct job, even though they might have the benefit of creating indirect. So that's that. And so maybe linking that with why do we need to show a profit? That's really for sustaining. It's not that is our core objective is development. But I mean, for us to be able to sustain that development, there needs to be an element of profit, not only at IDC level, but for the companies that we fund. Because that talks to the question to say, do we fund companies even though they don't make a profit, or is it the job? So we're saying if the company that we fund has to be sustainable, to us by implication, then the jobs that we're trying to protect have a greater chance of being protected than if it's a company that is always continually going to be making a loss. So that sustainability, in fact, to us, we would probably maybe refer to sustainability more than to profit, because we want to make sure that we can sustain ourselves, and then we can be able to those companies that we fund can sustain themselves and grow in fact. In terms of the vacancies that we're referring to, it's IDC vacancies. It's not for the companies that are in distress. So we've looked at to say, but we don't have very large vacancies. I think because in the nature of the business, people there's a turnover, but it's in fact we've actually compared to the industry, it's much less. I think it's ours is very very low. But those are the vacancies I was talking about, the IDC vacancies, not necessarily the companies that are in distress. And I think we take note of the temporary contractors. We have not used them, as I said now, but I'm saying it's something that we'll keep open if there's a need. But we note the advice that we've received from the committee that when we go that route, we should not necessarily now end up giving away what we are capable of doing. In terms of the long-term nature, how long is long-term? Christo van Zyl will talk about that. But maybe just a point of clarification on the slide, if it has caused confusion, I apologize, Chair. The examples that we've shown, some of those companies, it's examples. It's not the whole picture. So it's not that whole all the examples. That's why if you were to try and add all of that, you won't find the picture, because there's a number of other companies that we have. It's just really to show the committee a sense of that. And then the companies that the rural companies, the rural figure that we have of 1.1 billion, I think that's for everything, not necessarily per province. That's for the whole the project. Chris, do you want to talk about how long, and then I'll come back?
The long-term sustainability of a company, that really depends on the project itself. In most sectors, you would look at a period 5 years and beyond to see whether the company is starting to be sustainable. But in some sectors, such as forestry, it might take 10 to 15 years for the company to start making profits to sustain itself. So the long-term depends on the sector and on the project. There was a question around the period for the stress funding. I think the Deputy DG did answer to some extent. What we're budgeting for currently is for funding in this year and in the next financial year. And obviously that will be reviewed as the economic conditions become more clearer.
Thanks, Christoph. I think there was a question on the bonds, particularly in this environment, and that we need to be careful. I think we welcome the advice, which is one of the reasons why we, as a start, look at the domestic environment, because we're cautious. Because if you, particularly IDC has not raised a bond in a long time. I mean, naturally, we've done bilaterals and syndications, which have worked. The first one that I referred to, which is where we've made significant progress, that's the private placing between us and the UIF, which will enable us to pass the benefit. But when we go out into the market, we're starting local. But we're also sensitive because there are other players which are going to the domestic market. So we're doing a proper analysis, and we're sensitive that we don't firstly crowd in the other institution, but also not to take unnecessary risk as far as that is concerned. Shakil will talk about the cooperative and our involvement in the industrial parks, or the lack thereof. Shakil?
To start with the industrial parks, we do have certain targeted investment areas where we try to encourage new developments. That includes rural areas, was mentioned, in particular the Integrated Sustainable Rural Development Program target areas, presidential nodes. There are industrial parks and industrial development zones. We also try and target developments specifically in and around the historical townships. Some of these are areas where it's difficult to make investments, but that's exactly why we need to focus on them, to try and encourage businesses to invest there. In terms of cooperatives, the government has launched a program to focus on cooperatives, and in line with that, we have started looking at to see how we can play a role. What we have done, we have been funding workers' trusts, so to enable workers to get a stake in a business. We've also been trying to get the communities around particular investments to get a stake in the business, and we have been funding them as well, sometimes in new projects, sometimes in acquisitions. So we encourage the companies to actually include them, but we also provide the funding to make that possible, and we help in terms of structuring that. In terms of setting up a pure cooperative, there have been relatively few approvals, but in the last year or so, we've increasingly been focusing on that in line, as I said, with government policy, and we expect to see that area growing going forward.
Thanks again, Chair. I think there's two questions which we'll cover. I'll talk about the shedding of jobs, but there's a question on the minimum wages, but I take it that includes the compliance with the laws of the country, which Takane will address. But in terms of the shedding of the jobs, Chair, probably didn't come out as clear as I hoped it will. When you fund a company and in the restructuring thereof, there might be a need that as the company positions itself to ensure that it's sustainable going forward. Let's say, for an example, it's got 1,200 employees. It might, in that process, say, okay, it will cut down the size by 300, as an example. So what we're trying to say is when we assist those companies, and that is probably an eventuality to happen, what we do as part of the conditionalities is trying to minimize that 300 to say it has to be a real, real, real need for it. So if there's a way in which instead of shedding of 3, maybe only shedding of 100, that's something that we engage with the company, we take it seriously. Because we want the money, particularly that we've earmarked for distressed companies, to save the job. But it might happen in some instances that we might lose in that restructuring, but we minimize it. That's what I was trying to say. And then Takane will deal with the last part in compliance with that.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to respond on the question relating to the non-compliance with the basic employment equity. Maybe let me just first by saying that no. Before IDC fund any entity, we really go through a basic assessment of various companies. And one area that we look at is the FICA. In other words, to look at know your client in terms of what are these companies all about. What do they do? Are they compliant with the necessary legislation of the country? For example, we require the necessary documentation that each company has to provide to the IDC before we fund. And at the same time, we also look at, is this company compliant with a number of legislation? Some of that will relate to the tax legislation, the area of basic employment equity. Is the company, are this company that we are financing in compliance with those requirements? But I must say also that IDC also fund largely the startup entities, which by virtue of being startup entities will not have necessarily already in existence. So the issue of compliance with basic employment equity might not necessarily at that moment of funding prevail. But as part of monitoring, ongoing monitoring, we require information from the client on an ongoing basis to ensure that the client is our clients are compliant with the necessary legislation of the country. I hope that satisfies the
Thanks, Chair. Sorry, Shakil just pointed out that there's one question which I skipped. The support mechanisms. Chair, we did say in the previous presentation that we do have a support mechanism, particularly for SMEs, because we did realize that it's not only the funding that will assist them, particularly for the first timers. So we would give them support. In some cases, we would even make facility grants available to them to if they have to be trained in specific areas, but also if we have to appoint somebody to handhold them. So we do have support mechanisms for that.
Thank you very much for the responses. Are there follow-up Mr. Singh? Or before Mr. Singh, can we give Mr. Ngonyama, because he raised his hand before? And then we'll come to Mr. Singh and then Mr. Singh. Any other hand? Okay.
Well,
in that order, please.
Thank you very much, Chair. I must say that, Chair, through you, that I have the picture with regard to rural development, which has been my and the source of concern, which actually leads to the exodus of people from the rural areas to the urban areas. And that IDC is sensitive to this. However, I just want to ask one thing, that when you actually embark on some of these projects, because of the limitation with regard to funding that you referred to, do you, in all the projects, hunt as only IDC, or you have plans of hunting more or less as a pack with other related and units like DBSA, for instance, Chair? And that is one, in order to ensure that you have a strong impact, especially with regard to intervention on and the companies under distress and also in some of the projects in the rural areas. The second part is on the regional participation with regard to the region. Is there any and the participation within the region? I've seen and the participation in Mozambique here. And what is the policy with regard to participation in the region? And the reason why I'm asking that question is because it's part of regional integration. And also, it's I was in Tanzania and about a week ago, then I met some business people that were complaining about IDC getting into sort of talks with them for a long time, and at the end, they usually say that we know that IDC will say no to our project, and right at the end. And so there isn't sort of a positive image which is coming out of the little that one money. I'm not saying that is a general. And please let me be understood, because I haven't done that scientifically. I'm just saying that those few that I met in that meeting, they were actually talking about this. The last one is, I see the interventions, Chair, and my last point is maybe it's based on strategy. Are these projects driven on demand only, or are they strategy driven? Because I imagine that in provinces, actually, there's competitive or advantage for each and every province with regard to their strengths. Are we funding them based on the strength of provinces with regard to and what they have, the capabilities of each and every province economically? And or are we funding them on the basis of the projects that actually come? Because you may have and the provinces that and they may not be coming up with a sort of a project quite and strongly. Let's take an example, for instance, of Northern Cape. And I'm just imagining, and maybe and the provinces that are relatively and the poor that may not be able to churn out projects. Do we, as IDC, work in a particular strategy? Thanks.
Thanks, Mr. Ngonyama.
Chairperson, I understand that IDC is focusing mainly on emerging companies. But I thought when you talk about the first companies, are those in existence and for some reasons, you know, valid or invalid, found themselves dysfunctional and need a bailout. That's why I was taking if IDC does consider such, you know, causal factors as to why the company is in distress. And you might think that, you know, basic conditions of employment is something very small. But that is a major reason why we have so many strikes and they impact negatively, you know, seriously on our economic development and all the programs that are taking to economic growth. And now that you talk of profits, big or small, but at the end of the day, they are profits. I just want to check which factors were considered when we approved the establishment of a private hospital catering for rural community in Limpopo. The reason why I'm asking this is that how many people in the rural area could afford a private hospital? Are we going to make profits out of that particular hospital? Or maybe its situation is maybe strategic, whether people think we are going to make a profit out of a rural, I mean a private hospital in a rural area.
Thanks, Mr. Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, there was one unanswered question, but maybe it will come in writing. Unsustainable projects in the last maybe 3 years or so. Can we have a list of those unsustainable projects and the list of those companies? The other question, follow-up, Madam Chair, is the does the IDC and their managers in the provinces, is there a silo mentality where you look at what happens in the province rather than what happens in the country? For example, with this earth moving equipment company of a 250 million run assistance, I mean, I'm sure there are many earth moving companies in the country. Why should one be taking stress because of economic downturn in KwaZulu-Natal when the others may be surviving? And if you listen to the MEC from KwaZulu-Natal or the Premier, I mean, they say things are looking rosy despite the recession in terms of economic development. So, I mean, what informs these kinds of decisions? And the next thing, Chairperson, is the tax-paying institution. We spoke about DFIs, and you are a tax-paying institution. What informs that? Maybe we must ask SARS, SARS are the right people to ask why are you tax-paying and the others are not tax-paying? It's an unfair advantage. And what has happened, what has DTI done to try and get this done? The last comment, Madam Chairperson, is to follow on the colleague in Ngonyama. Is rapid urbanization. We know it's a scourge of our community. People are move away from the families, HIV and AIDS and things like that, if you look at the cities. What targeted interventions are there for industrial development in rural areas? We've heard about the Integrated Rural Development Program, but it doesn't seem to focus much on industrial development. Because if there are industries in rural areas, people will not move to the cities and be blinded by the bright lights and they think, you know, there's mana from heaven, and but nothing happens there. They're unemployed there.
Thank you,
sir.
Thanks, Mr.
Singh.
I'll give Mr. Wong.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to know from the IDC approval for the order is funding here. Then I see that this detail, just the CEO reply say, this is not a full detail for the amount for the 3.4 billion. So I agree, but from the inside, I didn't see the how many BEE for the enterprise from the you approved that is funding. I want to know how many is all the cost, how many percent for the involved for the BEE? Thank you.
Thank you. I take it that you're still going to forward the list of the company. And so any question related to that, I think we should put a packet until we get the list.
I wanted to suggest that with the sensitivity, because really, and that the point that the IDC was raising with regard to sensitivity, I wanted to suggest that that information should be given to you only. Then you'll find a way of sharing with us. Because even as we sit here, we're having media. And I'm just wary of the fact that, and maybe tomorrow the companies get to know, then it says that it's us here. And I'll definitely feel guilty myself as an individual And so I suggest that it's given to you, Chair.
Okay, we will conclude on that after the meeting, when we're meeting on our own. We will conclude on that. Can we park it until that time and allow the IT, and then we'll come back to the ITC on that. Mem
Protesi,
you have an issue?
Yeah, can I make a reminder about the list of addresses that you are asking for? Can you also remind your colleagues that they also requested a breakdown in terms of race and gender? Who they funded?
They did forward that. I must say that it was, they did forward, and we emailed it to all members. And we did post to members. I did see that in my email. I saw that information. Maybe you must check your email. I know you were not there last week.
Yeah.
Yes, you were not there. So please check that information. And if you feel it's not enough, then you can come back on that one and make a follow up. Thank you.
Chair, if I could have come in on some of the high level issues. You start off with the matter of providing the details of companies. Could I just request that the IDC be given an opportunity just to test, you know, what their legislative obligations are in this regard, you know, in terms of the Companies Act and the banking legislation and so on. I'm not for a moment trying to suggest that this information shouldn't be forwarded. But just to find the appropriate way of sending it to the committee, and as one of the members has suggested, you know, to make sure that, you know, no legal confidentialities are broken in the process. If that's acceptable.
We don't mind that, Mr. Nimrod, but here we are looking also at the interests of government, because we are overseeing the government. The work of the government. What we are saying is that we have money that we are putting, you know, or forwarding to this company. And then you remember that our obligation is with respect to also the constitution of this country. And one of the areas is that must be as transparent as possible. Notwithstanding that, of course, we are saying we'll give, we will give the IDC an indication of what exactly the committee has decided on that, and then we will then we'll come back to you immediately after our meeting so that you know what to do. But we'll also look into all those things. Obviously, our we'll also seek our legal experts, and we'll be able then to conclude. Can we agree on that? And I will request that the media doesn't make any much of an issue out of this, please, so that we can be able at the same time assist the public to have information, the correct information, and be able to see what the government is doing, and appreciate even the difficulties that we are operating. And can we agree on that? Okay. Can we proceed with the responses? We have 3 minutes to do so.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. We'll try and do this speedily. Chair, we noted the comment on the rural development. I think it is we are sensitive to that, which is, I'll repeat, one of the reasons why we have provincial offices, so that they are closer in the provinces, they know what is happening. They can also, because our approach is two-pronged. Sometimes we'll be responding to things that are coming up, but also we'll help proactively try and develop projects in those. I think that ties back to the ability to have projects, industrial projects. I mean, if you look at, I said we're looking at solar, we're looking at natural fiber, we're looking at bioethanol. So some of these projects we have proactively, on as IDC, said we need to play a role in those particular projects and in particular provinces. We're also conscious of that. I think the challenge is always to try and strike a balance, that you build something, it doesn't become a white elephant that it works. But I mean, it's a two-pronged approach. We respond, but we're also proactive in trying to find those big projects
I mean, that will have an ability of making a difference in a particular area. So there's a number of them that we have in the pipeline. I think as they develop from time to time, we will share with the committee some of those. They are different stages. Our focus, maybe to help, I think the member, I think probably didn't come out as well as it should have. It's not only the startups that we do. We do existing companies, we do expansion. So, in fact, most of the companies that are in distress that we're helping, not startups, are existing companies. We look at, but likewise, as we look at them as well, we ensure that they comply with the laws of the country. I mean, if employment equity is one of them, that is important. If minimum wage is conditions of employment, it's important. I mean, otherwise we would perpetuate a wrong behavior. So we're very strict on that. The private hospital in a rural area, I think it's evidence of the fact that it's not only the profit that we're looking at here. We're looking at the ability for people to access medical aid, and particularly for those that can afford it. So we have a two-pronged approach to say, how can we partner with the public sector, the PPP that we do that, but also in the private sector, those that can afford it, and then we make a facility available for them. So, but it's not only the profit. I mean, to us, it's sustainability. So, I mean, for us to, if that was the drive, I don't think we'd even start looking at a private hospital in a rural area. Our team, we encourage them not to work in a silo mentality. So we'd have the people in the region that look broadly, but also we have people that look at the sector to say, how can we develop the sector and the broadness of the sector. So we discourage silo mentality because you want to have the benefit of knowing a broader picture because it's just a narrow one. On the SARS and the text, I think I'll leave that to the DDG to assist us on that. I think we've noted the point on the project that has been not sustainable pathways. I think that information we will pass to, and the percentage of the BE funding, because we don't have it here, we will pass that to the members.
While I said that you did forward information regarding the gender, you know, parity in terms of your finances, but then I also think that the information was too congested. You had the previous, you didn't perhaps deal with that information according to what you are doing now, starting from the previous financial year. It sort of relates to, you combine the previous and the current. If you can just try to split that information, that it would assist us.
Thanks, Chair. From the DTI side, we are looking at possibilities to strengthen the balance sheet of the IDC, obviously taking into consideration that we are in a very difficult fiscal position at the moment as a consequence of the economic crisis. And one obvious thing that we're looking at is making some proposals with respect to the tax status of IDC relative, let's say, to the DBSA. Just if I could maybe make a, I think there was a point about regional, both continent-wide and within the South African economy, perhaps some high-level points. I think for us, regional integration is extremely important for obvious reasons, and so we support the supportive projects on the rest of the continent. I think one of the areas that we're going to be pushing the IDC more towards is to say how do we maximize the developmental impact of these projects? For instance, how do we make sure that that the projects, you know, are there greater possibilities for them to procure, both from South Africa, South African capital equipment? Are there greater possibilities for them to procure more from the countries in which they're located, because we believe that the fundamental constraint to regional integration is the productive capabilities of the countries in the sub-region. On the rural development side, I think we're certainly looking at possibilities and sectors that can contribute to greater rural development. And I think one of the issues there, again, perhaps talks to one of the roles that this committee might be able to assist in, is assisting in
in expediting, you know, some of the broader policies and regulations that are necessary to get some sectors off the ground. So, you know, for example, we believe there's a lot of potential in biofuels. IDC is already investing, you know, looking at investing in four large biofuel projects. There's potential, we believe, in areas like aquaculture and mariculture, fish farming. Again, it requires certain regulations to be put in place. Tourism, areas of agro-processing, but many of these also talk to more joined-up government in order to expedite the development of these sectors. Another example one can give is, you know, the development of forestry, particularly in the Eastern Cape. You know, there, there's an issue of some of the regulatory issuing of water licenses, etc., you know, which if those could be expedited, could actually, you know, much more rapidly unlock economic development in outside our traditional metropolitan areas.
Thank you. Are you done?
Just one point, sorry, Chair. On the, I think Mr. Ngonyama talked about the Tanzania experience. If you look at our portfolio, about 15% value-wise is outside of South Africa and largely into the rest of the continent. And we have about 48 projects at different stages. So maybe I could get maybe more information on that particular incident, but it's not something that we try and encourage.
Thank you very much. You have something to say, ma'am? I thought I was...
So we are done, Chair. I agree. Just the last one. No, I've just got information from members being here. I'm just commenting on it that it is really not what we requested from the department. We have here, let's say, black empowered and female owned rural business. We said the name of the business, what they do, is it women maybe baking cakes? And men doing something, you know, very serious when you talk about the community development. And what you said before about the addresses and whatever, I'm not sure how to explain this, but also we said you don't want to be deceived by the concept or term black, one black, white, colored Indian in this question.
Okay, that's a lot of information, I know. But I think, I guess the CEO, you will try and make it as reader-friendly as possible while giving us more information that we need. I don't know how I'm going to package it, but make sure that it is something that is readable. Thank you. In with the IDC, your SOE, but... what we need to be assured on is whether they are not working in isolation. As much as we understand, you know, their reason for existence and the fact that it's long that you've not been funding them, but the fact is that they're still government attached. What I'm trying to say here is that we need to be assured that they are following what the priorities of government. And they are really on the agenda of government and not doing something else because of the challenges that they might be facing. That's why we are here. The government is there for them if they experience any difficulties. In as far as their mandate is concerned, they can always go back to government. We really appreciate the work that the IDC is doing here. We know it's not an easy task, especially during this period. Last time we did ask you the question whether that 6.1 billion was enough. You came up with a response today that it might not, but you are looking at other avenues in terms of raising those additional funding. That shows us that you are really doing your work. But you must understand also our role here is to ensure that this framework agreement is implemented without any failure. and we need to be convinced that what we are doing is really going to plow back to our people and is going to save, especially the poorest of the poor who are really experiencing the poverty that everybody is talking about. At the same time, we need to grow our economy. We agree on that. And fortunately, you are one of the institutions that are assigned to do that, to help in growing that economy. So that's why I'm saying your work is a bit difficult because you are doing, you know, many things in one. And we appreciate what you've done so far. We don't undermine the work that you are doing. Thank you very much and continue to assist because we need you for our people to experience a better life. Can we also thank the media because they keep us informed at all times. And we want to thank you really for coming in and always being there to get information and taking it to the public as it is within a particular context that we discussed here, and we really appreciate your effort. Thank you very much. We will get the documents. We'll await your documents. Please ensure that you give us as soon as possible. We have a program in place that we would want to pursue, and it includes visiting some of the companies. Please make sure that we receive. I don't know what time frame can we give, and within the context of the program, the intervention program that the government has, what is it that the Department of Labor has for us and stuff. So please feel free to give us as much as information as possible. Can we hand over to yourself? I don't know whether you know the members. Starting from my extreme left, we have Mr. Singh. He's a member of this committee from IFP. We have Dr. Rabi, who's a member also from DA. We have Mr. Ngonyama, from the ANC. From COPE. And then we have next to him, we have Mr. Huang, who's a member from the ANC. And then we have Mr. Khreileng, who's a member from ID. And then we have Mr. Ntuli, the member and also the whip of this committee from the ANC. Mr. Mabaso, who is a member and also he sits in the management committee of this committee. In the ANC, yes, he's from the ANC. Ma'am Sotet just joined there on the extreme left. She's a member from the ANC. And we have here Ma'am Bengu, who's also a member from the ANC, and then the committee secretary, Ariko Kose. We also have people from the department and the media here. So, and also from the parliamentary staff. Okay. Now that you know who we are, I am the chair of the committee, Mem Matulari Coleman. Now that you know us, please address us.
Thank you very much, ma'am. In the correspondence that we've received, you were asked to come and address the committee on two things, the training layoff and the department's view on the labor broker issue. Ian will take the committee through on the training layoff, and I'll talk to the committee on the labor broker issue. Ian.
Thank you, Tammy Coates. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity. Chair, with your permission, I'm going to assume that the committee has some information on the training layoff. So if I may, I would just like to focus on some of the slides. There's quite a lengthy slide presentation which covers all aspects, but I would prefer just to focus on some key aspects and give you an update on where we are at the moment, and then rather take questions if I may proceed like that. But if you require further information, you can just guide me. I don't have the presentation, I'm afraid. The IT, I think, is on the way. So if I can speak to the slides that have been distributed.
As long as you understand that we are seeing you for the first time.
Yes.
We might have read information that we were given. Yes, we were addressed by the minister, and he gave us the general information in terms of that, and he did forward a documentation to ourselves, of which members do have also. But we'll appreciate from the labor point of view. Yes.
Okay. Okay, let me start. Okay, thank you. In that case, I'm just going to skip the first slide, which I do think you will be aware of the background to the training layoff scheme, the framework agreement, which really started the ball rolling on this issue. And that was obviously in the context of the international economic crisis at the time in February, which then, thank you very much, which then became the recession that we're experiencing in South Africa. And our starting point, just to move to the third slide, were these words in the framework document that in addition to other measures to avoid retrenchment, one further option that the parties will consider is the training layoff, financed by the NSF, the National Skills Fund, which is in the Department of Labor, and the CETAs, the Sector Education Training Authorities, for workers whose employers would ordinarily retrench them, which can be introduced on terms that keep them in employment during the downturn, but reskill those workers as an investment for the future economic recovery. That was essentially the guideline that then went into the committee of social partners and governments that worked in NEDLAC, starting from early March. Obviously, we didn't quite anticipate the interruption that we would have through the election. So work was quite slow at first, but it picked up quite rapidly in May and through till the 21st of August, when the leadership team chaired by the Minister of Economic Development adopted the guide on the training layoff. That document, and I also say this for the reference of the colleagues from the media that are present, that document is available on our website, on the website of the Presidency, the website of the CCMA, and it really outlines, in effect, what we could call the rules and the procedures of the training layoff. It's called the guide to the training layoff, and that's really the most important document that we have currently to work with. Just speaking from that document, what is the training layoff? Well, it is, as the framework document indicates, it's a temporary suspension of work for a worker or group of workers that is used for training. That's very important. It's a temporary suspension of work, so it's not for people who are already retrenched. We've had many queries from companies that have already retrenched many workers. How can they access the layoff? This is a temporary suspension of work. So it's aimed at people in employment. And it depends, number two, and very important, it depends on an agreement. If you're keeping people in employment but you're doing something different, you affect their conditions of work. And therefore, there has to be some agreement between the employer, the union, or where there's not a union, between individual workers. And thirdly, it's aimed very importantly at workers who might be subject to dismissal for operational requirements. Now, those words, operational requirements, come from the Labor Relations Act, which is how our department was involved, because this is principally starting off as a legal process that's regulated under the Labor Relations Act. It involves the Commission for Conciliation, Mediation and Arbitration. I'll come back to that. And then finally, it's important to note that participation in the scheme is voluntary. Having said that, the NEDLAC social partners have put in the document a strong wording to urge the social partners to make use of the layoff. What are the aims? Quickly, there are five key aims. We want to try and retain employment. We want to avoid retrenchments as far as possible. We want to enhance skills. We want to support companies to survive the recession, and we want to position employers and workers to take advantage of when the green shoots become taller grass and the economy takes off, and we encourage the social partners to participate. The main aspects I've mentioned, that we're dealing with a temporary suspension of work. Very important, there's no change, no major shift in the employment contract. The contract between the worker on a training layoff and the employer stays in place. So to all intents and purposes, these are still employed workers that we are dealing with. The training, well, there have been lengthy discussions about what would be the nature of training. The agreement has been it should be flexible. It should link to the needs of the company. Obviously, one would like the workers at the end of the layoff period to be reabsorbed into the work as that they were doing at the time that the layoff kicked in. But the key aspect is that instead of a normal wage, a worker who agrees to participate in the layoff would get an allowance and not his or her normal wage. And for the employer is expected to carry a basic package of social benefits. And already with those few cases that have been starting up at the CCMA, a lot of the queries are not so much on the allowance, that's quite clear, but on the basic social benefit package. In the discussions in the NEDLAC task teams and what the leadership team endorsed, we said principally one should have three things that should not be interfered with in your social benefits. Number one, and this is speaking from the Department of Labor, we want the unemployment insurance fund contributions to continue, and the employer pays for both. Number two, we do not want a worker to jeopardize his or her retirement savings. So pension and provident should continue. And number three, any death and disability benefits that there might be for that worker at the time that the layoff starts, that might be separate from a pension or provident fund, those should continue. So unemployment, retirement savings through pension and provident, death and disability. That's the basic package, and that's non-negotiable. If an employer does not agree to pay the full contribution, there's no agreement, and there's no training layoff. How does it work? Well, it's subject to ultimately the recommendations, and I'll come back to this, that flow through from the CCMA to our department, and there's a committee that's meeting for the first time on Friday, I believe it is, of the National Skills Fund, the Unemployment Insurance Fund, our skills section, and that committee would finally approve the participation by an applicant in the scheme. Workers remain employed. I've dealt with that. Employers pay the contributions. We've dealt with that. And importantly, the number four here is that the training layoff may be combined with short-time work arrangements. Now, for those of you who don't know quite what's been happening since last year and the beginning of this year, many companies, particularly in the manufacturing sector, their first response, those that didn't retrench, was to negotiate short-time working arrangements, which is perfectly possible either under collective agreements or under the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. So many
companies have been for months already on short time, and workers have been working 1 or 2 days a week, and they've been at home for the rest of the time with a reduced wage. And of course, as soon as the layoff started to be discussed, there was a big push, particularly from the Metal Workers Union, NUMSA, that we need to find a link between the layoff and short time. And we did do so. The details are in the document. But essentially, there is a way now of combining, if you're on short time, working not more than 2 days a week, of still coming into the training layoff for the balance of those days, or a number of days over an 8-week period. So you could still be drawing your pay for your short time and an allowance for your training. But we've set caps, I'll come back to that, and maximums to ensure equal treatment and maximum access to the training layoff. But the short time link is very important, and we expect that some of the initial take-up will in fact be through particularly the motor companies that have been working short time for many months. We've had approaches from Ford, BMW, and others, and we think it's probably a matter of weeks before they should have agreements that give them access to the training layoff. This all is going to be for an initial period of 3 months, and then we'll review, depending on how much uptake there is, how much money we have left in the National Job Fund, which is what we're calling it. How is the scheme delivered? Well, very importantly, there's one point of entry, and that's the Commission for Conciliation, Mediation and Arbitration. All parties who want to participate start with the CCMA. And the CCMA recommends participation, and they facilitate a training layoff agreement, and these documents have been finalized, they're ready, they're working, they are important documents. There's a training layoff agreement, it has an attachment which sets out terms and conditions that have to apply during the layoff regarding leave arrangements, regarding discipline, regarding sick leave and a whole range of labor-related issues. Those have been sorted out in an annex to the training layoff agreement. So one has to have, as I said before, an agreement to be able to come into the training layoff. That's important. And what's also important is that agreements aren't reached overnight. They take a bit of time. So we're dealing with a scheme that, in effect, might take, for some parties, it might take a week or 10 days before they reach agreement. A number will walk away, and there won't be an agreement. So it's important to realize that we're varying conditions of employment by agreement, and one has to be patient and give the parties time to conclude an agreement that they're satisfied with. The CETAs will then facilitate the provision of training, fund the training costs, and send an application through to the Department of Labor. Our committee will consider that and pay the training allowances to the CETAs. The CETAs disburse the money to the affected companies, and the companies will pay the workers their allowances and contribute the basic social benefit package. Who may use the scheme? Well, any employer, trade union, individual worker or group of workers can participate. So it's not restricted. In the early days of the discussions, we did say this should be only for companies who pay the skills levy. Through the negotiation, it was opened up. It's now an open scheme available to anybody, any employer, trade union, or worker, but only workers earning up to 180,000 per annum, and, of course, who may be at risk of retrenchment. We had to arrive at some sort of cap to stay in line, I think, with the principles in the framework document, which is really to assist the most vulnerable, those who are going to be most affected by the recession that we have been in. And if you look at the figures for employment published by Statistics South Africa, you will know that most of the retrenchments have been firstly in the informal sector. Those are the most vulnerable, which first lose access to jobs and resources, and secondly it's been what Statistics have called the elementary workers or the less skilled. Those have been the first to feel the impact of the recession. So with that in mind, we set an income cap for coming into the scheme. And that works as a, if you like, as a hard rule. The training guide chair has what we could call hard rules and soft rules. And this is one of the hard rules. If you're above the allowance, sorry, you can't access the scheme. The company might be able to assist in other ways, to retain skills, but the training layoff and government will not be able to assist with an allowance. The scheme is limited to employers who are in distress, and I know there will be some questions on this, so let me just say that there is a committee operating at the CCMA that includes financial skills, accountants, business analysts, and they analyze financial documents that, as the parties are discussing the agreement, the CCMA requests income and expenditure statements, balance sheets, monthly cash flow statements and projections. And a little bit like the IDC, as you were hearing before the break, there will be an analysis of whether the distress is genuine in this company. And that will form part of the CCMA's thinking before it makes a recommendation. This one, the fourth issue here is more difficult, that ideally employers should be in position to benefit from short-term relief. If the company is at a point where, let's say, the employer says, I can't even afford to continue to carry the UIF contribution, that's 2%, probably that company shouldn't be thinking about the layoff. Unfortunately, ma'am, they should probably be looking at what other measures are necessary, whether that's liquidation or retrenchment. But we're aiming at retaining capacity in the economy, and therefore it should be companies that, through this intervention, have a reasonable chance of making it. And that, in part, is their calculation as well. Where was that? Okay. Employers must be compliant with statutory obligations. Who pays? Well, you know by now, I think, that we contributing from the Department of Labor $2.4 billion, half of that from the National Skills Fund, and the other half from a reserve in the Unemployment Insurance Fund. Other parts of the UIF reserve have gone to the IDC to support loans, extension of loans to companies in distress, but 1.2 of that surplus has come into the training layoff. The committee I've mentioned, the CETAs are covering the cost of training I've mentioned, and I think the last point just to repeat is that workers who participate would forego 50% of their normal wage. So the allowance is calculated at 50% of your normal wage, up to a maximum of 6239 per month. 6239 per month. So that's another hard rule in how the scheme is going to work. What are the terms and conditions? Well, some of this is a repeat, so I'm going to go quite quickly through of this, but we've mentioned the allowance and the maximum up to 180, the 50% of the normal wage up to 6239 per month. And here we come to the formulation on the full-time and the part-time. We're effectively dealing with two types of training layoff: a full layoff, which lasts at least 4 weeks, or a partial layoff lasts at least 2 days a week or 16 days in an 8-week period. Those are the minimum time requirements. It cannot be less than that. So we're dealing with a full layoff and a partial layoff. Going a bit further, the social benefit contributions I've outlined. There's the idea of a basic social security package, and that kicks in at the time that the layoff starts. And in the second point, you've got the details. Thirdly, and very importantly, parties are free to negotiate a continuation of all existing social benefit contributions, and that would obviously include things such as medical aid, housing allowances. There may be a range of other benefits, and I would be surprised if in a unionized company the first demand when starting to talk about an agreement wouldn't be, let's just continue all the benefits, and the employer carries those, the workers will accept to take a 50% cut effectively in the wage, which probably still would balance out as a very substantial saving on the payroll of any employer. But that's subject to negotiation. What type of training options apply? Well, I've said they should be linked as far as possible to the needs of the company and the skills that make sense for investing further in the human resources within that company, but it can be varied. It can be generic skills, adult basic education and training. We've also said in the guide that a basic ICT, information communication technology package, is always useful. We know that in the South African workforce, there's a general low level of ICT skill, and in a sector such as mining, where there's a fair amount of interest already from mining companies, we know that there are literacy and numeracy shortage of skills. So it's not too difficult to package a short-term training program around generic skills such as ABET or ICT, and to agree that this could make sense for a worker who's willing to take a cut in wages in order to retain the possibility of employment. I've touched on the collective agreement. The training layoff agreement effectively, in legal terms, constitutes a collective, or where there's an individual worker, an individual agreement that varies their normal conditions of employment. So your employment contract is in place, but your conditions are varied through the training layoff agreement that you sign off on either as a union or as a worker at the CCMA. And that's how we move forward in line with the Basic Conditions of Employment Act and the Labor Relations Act. Now, what's important is that after an agreement has been signed off, it should not have the effect of varying down any conditions of employment. And this is where our landscape becomes a bit more complicated, because, as you'll know, we have over 40 bargaining councils operating in this country. They have agreements which cover employers in particular sectors. To give an example, we have close to four clothing textile companies that are already in negotiations on agreements. The clothing textile sector is covered by the National Bargaining Council of the Clothing Industry, which has a national agreement. It's a very lengthy and comprehensive document. The training layoff agreement cannot conflict with any obligations under that bargaining council agreement. If it does, then an employer has to immediately apply for an exemption. And we've written to every bargaining council to encourage them to deal with applications for extension from companies moving into the layoff on an urgent basis, and to expedite those exemptions so that, you know, there can be relief to these companies. But that's essentially what the third point is pointing to, that there cannot be interference with other regulation of conditions through existing agreements. And I've mentioned the role of the CCMA. Let me jump to the next one. And let me just pause and highlight three scenarios which are quite important to understanding how the training layoff will work. And essentially, it's three ways in which the CCMA could become involved. Firstly, through discussions under what we call Section 189A of the Labor Relations Act, where an employer serves a notice to say, I would like assistance of the CCMA commissioner to facilitate consultation about alternatives to retrenchment. That's scenario one. The CCMA brings the parties together, they talk, And the CCMA puts on the table the training layoff to say, would you like to consider this alternative? And then the process continues through to conclusion of the agreement. The second scenario is where the training layoff arises from a request to participate from a party in the labor market who is not involved in the CCMA process. So let's just say a company such as BMW, which is a case where we might well have an agreement. They've been on short time for many months. They're in distress. They're planning a big investment and new production changes in their production lines next year. And there's a lot of pressure on the company. But they quite sophisticated in their labor relations. They negotiate an agreement with NUMSA, and they simply send through the agreement to the CCMA. And they request the CCMA to have a look at that agreement. And that then comes to scenario three, where such an agreement is concluded. And what the CCMA does is essentially to check that that agreement complies with the rules and the procedures that have been negotiated for the scheme. So there are different ways of coming in. They get fairly complex. To be honest, we don't know all the permutations. The training layoff has never been tried in South Africa before. The CCMA is well prepared, but where there are many possibilities, you can't second guess everything that might come at you. And so there's going to be a learning experience. Our role, well, I think I've covered most of that. We have a committee that will consider recommendations. We've put up, as the department, the $2.4 billion to try and assist and to try and avoid retrenchment. And we'll work